said one thing, but the watch hasn't spoken. From the Department of Religion, letting, taking cognizance of this case. Also, members of Parliament in the act. Today, we are hoping that obviously we have the Department here, which we do, and the Department's legal advisor. Relevant to various aspects of what's before us. We were also hoping to hear somebody from the office of the supervisor. And at times, like the common rate, we are fortunate to have an elementary law advisor. But today I feel like that gentleman great distinction in the Bible. We call the party and nobody came back. I was just saying that I can't see anybody from the state law advisor's office. I won't say speak of the devil. It is assuming that you are the devil. I won't say that. But having said that, you may proceed to deliberate on the earth. You are starting with I'm not sure if the part of ideas that is placed in the agenda, but we are dealing with a political amendment, citizen amendment, the president amendment. So either of the two, the day for members of Parliament and to listen to all the legal advisors, the Department of State Law advisors, and the Parliamentary advisors, if and when he or she is filled up. That's the process. No one else is speaking yet. The days for stakeholders, we have public hearings, that's behind us. So that's the process of this one. Process we are following. Welcome everyone. So you may comment. And then as we go along, the state law advisors can also empower us with their views in regard to the different aspects of the two processes. Thank you. Department, you are in your able and gentlemen, I can safely say gentlemen, I don't see any women in the delegation. I'm sure the women take all the hard work that you are presenting. Thank you. We thank them in the effort.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much, Chair. As we have it on our that report to us, we're dealing with the SA Citizenship Amendment Bill today. I think next Tuesday is the Working Day Registration Amendment Bill that I've seen the every colleague here.
No, we can deal with both of them if the Department is just prepared for the citizens and also the scope of the issues are such that it would not be doing justice to seek to rush to deal with those. So we'll deal with what we have come prepared to do.
Thank you very much, Chair, honourable members. The first submission that we would want to go before we go through the bill clause by clause and just touch on certain issues that were raised and our comments to those issues. We looked at the Commission on Gender Equality, the presentation that was made. And one of the comments there is that we must include a definition of traffic, the traffic person, as well as, let's say, a lawful provision involved, who can enable victims of human trafficking to receive assistance, not only to be repatriated, but also to be considered for citizenship on account of the state of victims of human trafficking. Our view in this regard is that we've got the trafficking bill currently in the Delta Clean Parliament that already addresses this issue. They will be, in terms of the immigration, having the permit issued to this person, because we want to have a victim of trafficking to be able to also bring forth, etc., etc., and criminalize the matter. But you don't want to treat the victim's citizenship necessarily in terms of the Citizenship Act. There are other processes and they're already being taken for the other law that is in process in Parliament at this point in time. That was the main issue that was raised by the Commission for Gender Equality. If we turn the other one that we had to look at is obviously the submission of the South African Law Society. They mainly dealt with the issue of Section 5. The term marriage is used in Section 5 of the Principal Act, which qualifies for naturalization in a period of 2 years, etc. Currently, the period is in the Act, it appears in the Act as a period of 2 years. What we're saying in the amendments is that we want to say a prescribed period, and their view is that we should leave it at the 2 year period, we should stipulate that in the Act. What we're saying is, if you go forward and you want to amend that specific period, say you want to 3 years or years, you don't have to come back to Parliament to amend that specific. That's why you want to put that in prescribed, so you want to put the amount, or the number of years in the regulation, to be able to amend that period within the regulation as the process. So basically, it was there, it is currently there, it's been redrafted to indicate for a prescribed period, which we will put in the regulation.
You know what I would like to suggest for the future, if not possible to do it now. In the past, when we have dealt with births, when it comes to this stage, the department has normally prepared what you are speaking to say, this is what is the question, these are the views that have been that they don't get the 50,000 years quality. This increase from it. And then if we are able to circulate that before the meeting through the office of the committee chair, it makes it easier for members to follow and engage with the issues. And also stakeholders. For now, it seems we have not been able to do so, but that's what is under the bridge. But at least as we move forward, that's always what we have to do.
Thank you very much. I'm really sure that that happens. I'm sure that you will be able to do this. I'm not sure that it is just to do the compliance. So apologies from our side and from the doctor. Section 5 also protects the indicated widows and widowers. They proposed that the term spouse should be included in the clause. To make provision for relationship terminated by death. So if one goes and reads, it is already there, widowers and widows, of course.
Once you are looking for the relevant subsection, state like that, if there is an issue that is being dealt with, please indicate if you want to express it with me.
Thank you, Chair. I'll do so.
Thanks, Chief. The specific deals with Section 5.5 of the Act and its currently in the Amendment Bill, which is Clause 5.8. You're saying the minister may not determine the provision of subject to one upon application prescribed and grant a certificate of naturalization as a South African to a foreigner who satisfies that he or she is the spouse or surviving spouse. So it deals with widows and your widowers, etc. So it includes both. It's not just that has been dealt with and taken care of in the amendment bill. It's already also indicated in the current Act.
That's why you are
there. Any comment, members? It might be more expeditious to pause for comments whilst we are just dealing with the relevant clauses instead of waiting for later and to deal with quite a number. If there's no comment, then we'll move. Okay? We may proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Clause 5F. This one, C. They're talking about the term marriage should be deleted and substituted with the words in a spousal relationship, as per the motivation where they say above of the definition of spouse. Chair, what we're saying there is if you look at the new clause 5F, specifically that amends section 5.5, one would say that in paragraph C it says married to such citizen during the period contemplated in paragraph B. And the term marriage has been defined in the Act as including all the pieces of marriage legislation that's currently in South Africa. So our view is that this has already been dealt with. In terms of the current pieces of, in terms of the definition of marriage in the bill, it now refers to its marriage concluded in terms of the Marriage Act, the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act, the Civil Union, or marriage concluded in terms of the law of a foreign country. So all the pieces of marriage legislation, so spouse will be included in there. Thanks, Chief.
Thank you, Chair. Just an addition in terms of the interpretation. When you are considering an application and someone is in a spousal relationship as determined in terms of the Immigration Act where it's either a permanent homosexual or a heterosexual relationship, those will be accommodated under the definition of merit because they would have complied with the requirements of the Immigration Act. So there would not be any kind of a discrimination or disqualification on the basis that someone is in a permanent homosexual or heterosexual relationship, not a marriage as defined. So they will already flow from the Immigration Act, so there will not be any discrimination in that respect. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, comment, Honorable Martin Zoshe.
Thank you, Sir. The idea or the contemplation around the submission as it stands, also the view that I have, is that at times you'll find that you have the responsibility left to the discretion of the officials concerned in those respective offices. And if the official likes you, then he acts or she acts in the manner that is suitable under the circumstances. And sometimes you'll find that the law or the act is then defined in the manner in which it becomes inconsistent, or rather defined in terms of the interpretation, in a manner that is not necessarily as it should be interpreted. So you are lawyers, yeah, but those people are not lawyers. They are simply administering or trying to execute the responsibility of implementation of that act. Now, the simpler this thing is put on paper, the better. So I would like to pose a question to the department lawyers, that in this case, how do you see being easier for those who are going to deal with this on a daily basis, so that we don't say that it is taken care of and we think that it is going to be easier and it becomes a very vague situation. So you also recognize that, you know, normally when we get queries, I do get a lot of queries. I remember in Khaled, in one particular instance, in the border, I think it's the Lesotho border, but the query was such that the officials at the National Head Office had to deal with something that should have been dealt with at that office. But because the Immigration Act was not so simple for those to execute.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I think what the substance of what the member is appealing for is this accurate, simple legal drafting as possible. It's not always easy, but what can take us nearer there? Then there's also the issue that for lawyers it's easy to cross-reference between the acts, but we should also bear in mind individuals who don't have the facility or ease to be able to cross-reference between the Citizenship Act and the Immigration Act and what have you. So within our bill and regulations, somewhere we should be able to make it as reasonably usable as possible for the person who has the facility of the bill or act in front of themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Yes, that is something we take that into consideration. We will have a look at that as well, and obviously, hand in hand with the state law advisors, we'll have to look at if we crop it. There is currently no definition of spousal relationship. As I said, we're trying to see that it's covered in terms of the definition of marriage. If you're a spouse, it means you're spouse in a marriage relationship, whether it's in terms of the Civil Union Act or law recognized in terms of a foreign country, there must just be proof of that, etc. So, but I take on board with the clear and simple drafting that we need to do, and we'll have a look into that, Chairperson.
Bye, thank you, Minister.
Thanks, Chair. The further, I think, issue that was raised during the deliberations for public hearings was on Clause 5B, the issue of ordinary residence and a continuous period, etc. It was indicated in Solid, I'm reading that, to the effect that the definition serves to prevent permanent residents from seeking naturalization where they have been absent from the country for periods of just a matter of months, where the employers may have sent them overseas. And I want to stop there. If that is indicated, if your employer is a South African employer and the employer sends you overseas, you're still an employee of a South African company. That shouldn't, you can't say that would be a hindrance. Or they have been forced by, for example, financial circumstances in order to support the family to seek temporary employment overseas. If you're going to seek temporary employment overseas, obviously you have to comply with other pieces of legislation like immigration laws of other country. And the other thing is all pensioners who visit their children overseas during South African winter months. So the temporary period that we're talking of here is, if you're going to visit your children for a month, that's fine. It is you're out of the country for a temporary period. But if you're going to be working overseas for 2-3 years, you get employment from another company abroad, that's something else. Then it's in terms of immigration regulation of another country. But if you're going over by virtue of the fact that your own company in South Africa has sent you abroad, you're still working and you're still a South African citizen in that specific, and that would qualify, it wouldn't be seen as a period that you're absent from the Republic because you're performing official duties for a company of South Africa. So that's how we interpret that specific section. But if you're going to be out of the country for a period of 2 years doing work for another company, as I've indicated, I'm actually regurgitating now, then surely that cannot be seen as that you're ordinary resident within South Africa. I don't know if I'm clear on that, Chair, if it needs more.
Just an addition, Chair. I think during our discussions when we're drafting the bill also, we indicated that we'll, in the regulations, clarify the issue of what is a continuous period and ordinary residence, so that it becomes clearer to everyone in dealing with that. And we'll be keeping with the trends in terms of if someone is going to visit us, Advocate Erasmus indicated, it would not be counted negatively. Even in the current instance, the only difference is that we take the period of 4 years out of the 7 years, which becomes a much complicated issue. But for example, in calculating the 1 year, we look at how often have you left. If it's for 1 day or 2 days, it doesn't count negatively. So there will not be any much negative impact, but we'll clarify that in the regulations. Thank you.
Again, for the sake of the people who are going to be seeking guidance from what we are doing here, you speak of regulations, but it would be important to get the thinking around those issues as soon as possible so that we can interact with those aspects. Normally you find a situation where bills are passed and then the regulation, they follow much later. So there's that period, that interregnum. What do you do then, you see? So there needs to be clarity. What's our thinking in regard to this as we move forward? So that more or less we know what will be included in the regulations. And also what we have sought to do, even in other portfolio committees that I had the honor of chairing, is to engage the ministry and the department, even in regard to the formulation of those regulations, so that they are brought to the portfolio committee and we are able to interact to test intention against practice. I see the end of the state law advisor. Sir.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to advise that if we want the regulations, we need to empower the minister to make regulations. If there's no empowerment, the minister won't be able to make regulations. So we'll have to look at it. If the idea is that the minister will make regulations, then we need to empower the minister in the act to make those regulations.
Thank you, sir.
Thank
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
If you could kindly identify yourself, some of you, the names are familiar, others are not.
Okay, my name is Luvo Vena. I'm with the Legal Services of Home Affairs. I will not speak against my colleagues. But another thing I wanted to caution against is to move some substantive provisions from the Act to the regulation as we go along.
Point noted. I'm sure your colleagues are also noting that. Members, any further comment? Baba.
Yeah, Chairperson, I must say the point raised by Mr. Vena now was my fear earlier, where for some reason because the other matter or issue cannot be exhausted here for one reason or two, then the matter is then raised in a regulation because it's easier to deal with it at that level. And then it further moves away from the intention, as you have alluded to earlier. So I think that will be defeated by the fact that if we engage, as the state law advisor advised, that if we engage or empower the minister, then that period should then give us space to engage. Then we can easily say, no, this is not what we've agreed on in terms of the Act. So I'm sure one of the things that was that would have helped these deliberations was an opportunity where we have been given these documentations before time so that we are then able to interact. But now we rely mainly on what you say orally instead of what is written before us. But we will try and test how far we can go. I must say from my side, it's very difficult. I have to, from time to time, look before me and he has to refer, and being them privileged as law or legal experts already, and they are even disempowering us. I'm not a lawyer as I'm sitting here, but I'm sure we are going to, let me be very positive rather than the other, and test how far we go with this one. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Member. That's exactly why, if you will recall, when we commenced the meeting, I said, moving forward, they'll provide us with this. Today is our initial take on this. So the next time we discuss this, we are getting all the views on board. They will provide us with that, and then we'll go through this exercise in a more refined manner. By then, we'll all be empowered. And the issue why I table the process in regard to the formulations of regulations, I'm not doing that for religious reasons. I'm doing it because it's a process that I know members are very interested in. So it empowers Parliament, representatives of the people, to engage the ministry, so to ensure that what we do here is in the best interest of citizens of this country. So we will have a role to play, even when regulations are formulated, to ensure that those do not go against the spirit and letter of what we have been engaging in here.
Thank you very much, Chair. And once again, apologies from us, that we'll ensure that even on this specific document, as we're discussing today, we'll go back and also work on that. Chairperson, Honourable Members, just to come back to the issue of making regulations, in terms of the current Act, and it's not being amended as I see, the Section 23 of the Act deals with the making of regulations, so the Minister is empowered to make regulations regarding certain issues, and also, if you read the legislation, if, like we say here, in the prescribed manner, it would indicate then, everywhere where the word prescribed manner appears in the amendment bill, it would mean that the minister can make regulations in that regard because she's authorized to make those regulations in terms of Section 23. However, obviously those regulations will only come into effect once the Act has also been amended. And just on the process that's being followed by the department, while we're working on the bill and amending legislation. We also have in the back of our minds the regulations, because we know that you have to have your regulations in place before you can bring your act into operation in order to try and cut down on that period or that lapses between the sanction of the bill and bring that into operation and the regulations in as well. So, Chair, we are busy with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's useful to share that, that the department is mindful of that process.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. If I may proceed then with regard to citizenship by birth, this is sections 2 and 4, and by naturalization, the definition of a major in terms of the Law Society of South Africa. Actually, what they indicated there, clause 2 and 4 of the bill, they agree with it, whether by birth or naturalization, to young adults who have lived their lives or their entire lives in concert with their parents, by the, for whatever reason. They spoke on those issues. Then came up the issue about the 17 years and 18 years and that the person must wait until he's a major. And the Law Society of South Africa said that the qualifying age threshold must be reduced to 17 years, where we're trying to link it up with your age of majority, like in terms of your Children's Act, which is now 18 years. And they made reference to matriculation, examinations, etc. But as we understand it, no child may be deprived of education, etc. So there are other pieces of legislation that would cover that. But for purposes of citizenship itself and naturalization in this specific regard, the view is still held that this person should reach the age of 18 years. And then furthermore, if then, when we get to the other sections as well, where that person's birth must then also be or have been registered in terms of the Birth and Death Registration Act, so that we've got that on our population register. Because remember, before you can issue an ID, and this links to your other legislation at the end of the day, before you can issue an identification document, your birth has to be captured on the NPR. Otherwise, you cannot be issued with an identity document.
Just to add, maybe before the issue about the age of 18, the intention is that at the age of 18, a person is able to make a decision of his or own. If we take it back to 17, then we are still leaving the decision to the parent at that stage, because the child is still a minor. So the intention was clearly to say that the child on his own, when becoming of age, must be able to make a decision regarding the citizenship issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. May Honourable Mawunye.
Thank you, Chair. My question is with regard to a child who is supposed to write the matric, because you will find that such IDs are requested from them. Now, what will happen if a child doesn't have an ID and she's or he's writing his or her exam?
Thank you. A pertinent question would also be to ask what happens presently.
Mm-hmm. So we just discussed with our land function officials of what currently is the...
Yeah.
I think one needs to look at the possibilities. You would have a child that's outrightly a foreigner, not a permanent resident. Now, in that case, as I have it, the child would have to be documented in terms of the Immigration Act, study permits and all of that. And it would depend on the requirements of the Department of Education, what documents they require for purposes of allowing children to study in South African schools. And we know it's happening because study permits are being issued. Now, if the child is a permanent resident, now a permanent resident is entitled to what we call a 1-8 ID number, which indicates the child as a permanent resident and as a non-citizen. Now, if the child is 16, the child then also then qualifies for an identity document, but it would be then, as I say, this one for a non-citizen, with a 1-8 number. And if education allows that as then confirmation of the child's status and identity, I take it that's what they will then use for purposes of allowing the child to write matric and to be issued with a matric certificate. So the distinction, between a foreigner without permanent residence and then a foreigner with permanent residence, I think those two one needs to just to look at. But that's how I have the current situation.
Thank you, sir. You refer to mainly to the aspect of a foreigner, but I'm sure the member is also referring to instances where South African children, for one reason or the other, they don't have an ID document and they are prohibited from writing matric exams. Anyway, it's a broader question. Even when we finalize this aspect, it would be one that we need to engage also with the Portfolio Committee on Education and also the Education Department in regard to problems that members of Parliament get via their constituencies, so that there's synergy in regard to this. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks, Chair. Honorable members. You'll remember when we register birth, a birth certificate is being issued with an ID number. And that ID number appears when the person applies for an ID book. So that ID number, when they write exams, then they use it and it's still valid. But we also try by all means to encourage learners at the primary level to have a birth certificate as a requirement for registration, so that going forward they shouldn't have experienced this problem when they write their metrics. Thanks.
Thanks. All those are important factors for even education officials to be aware of. If a child comes with a birth certificate and it has the relevant ID number, they shouldn't be saying that we want your green ID book. So it's a question of advocacy between departments. We'll seek to do our bit in that regard. But it's good that members flag some of the practical issues so that we can also deal with unintended consequences at times of the laws, regulations that we pass.
Thank you,
Mr. Skamafur. Sondring water.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The next issue that, and we don't really have a problem, it's just a question of a realignment of wording that was proposed by the Law Society. If one looks at...
You have to tell us which is the next issue. Because you remember members don't have your same document in front of them. If you say the next issue, they are wondering which is this issue. So you'll have to take us by the hand today.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, it deals with citizenship by birth, the wording that's used there, as well as citizenship by naturalization. And all they want to do is to align the word, and I'll point out the specific clauses that they're talking of there. It's clause 2-4A, which appears on page 5 of the bill. We say he or she has lived in the Republic from the date. And what they want to do there is that paragraph A should be aligned with the wording contained in paragraph A in clause 4. So that's in line on page 5, line 34 or 33 and 34. It says he or she has lived in the Republic from the date of his or her birth to the date of becoming a major. And their suggestion was that we should also use that wording in paragraph A. In paragraph A, where we say, in clause 2-4, where we say he or she has lived in the Republic from the date of birth to attaining the age of majority. They just indicated there that we should align. But it's neither here nor there. One can align them. It doesn't have any impact, really. It's just a question of the wording.
So it's a question of drafting. Then, depending on... the other clauses to seek to have consistency throughout whichever, yeah.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. If I may move on, the next issue that they deal with is the issue of loss of citizenship, which is contained in Section 6 of the current Act. It's also dealt with in Clause 6 on page 6 of the Amendment Bill. And I know that this issue was also raised when we did the presentation, the initial presentation on paragraph C, where there's a new inclusion to indicate that he or she engages in a war under the flag of a country that the government of the Republic does not support. And the question that came up, that's very confusing. Does it mean the flag? Does it mean the country? Does it mean the war? And we've gone back, and I know that we've also had discussions in this regard, and what I would want to propose in this regard, obviously it relates to the war that the Republic does not support. That is the intention of this whole clause. So if one then drafts it in a manner to indicate that he or she engages in a war, comma, under the flag of a country, comma, that the government of the Republic does not support. Just to the comma, then obviously if it's actually for he or she engages in a war that the government of the Republic does not support. The use of the word under the flag of a country, it's just because you're fighting under another country's... that's a suggestion from our side, a chairperson, if that might be of any assistance. We would suggest that we draft it in that manner.
Thanks. The commas lent more clarity to that particular phrase. Now we did around members. Was this not vacuous?
Listen, the privilege that we also have is that we've interacted on this matter, on the particular bill, the one on the table now, not so long ago. So the memory is still there. One of the major issues also some members here raised around this particular section is that the wording probably needs to be put together in a manner that does not prejudice those who are concerned or those involved, so that it is also not left to the interpretation of a particular minister in office at the time without giving due regard to the fact that South Africa generally would not pronounce in supporting a war or whatever unless there are treaties to that effect, which then presupposes that country A or B is supported or not. Now, the other question was, or is, has there been an instance recently where South Africa said, no, we are supporting the war in whatever country, hence we're deploying our soldiers? So does the deployment of soldiers or not deploying soldiers in a particular state declare that you're supporting the war? So it opens up a can of worm. Well, it's put like that. I would say it is put in a manner that becomes at times somehow irresponsible to give those members who are sitting in those offices to read these and to exercise their responsibility, even though the minister after all has a due regard to take responsibility over that particular implementation of this act, of this particular section. So it's very difficult. Unless it's put again in a manner that is simpler and more prescriptive in the manner when you say support, what you mean by support, or that the South African South Africa does not support, how do you support, how do you define the word support?
Thank you, member. I'm sure the portent of what you say is appreciated by the department. The major issue here is to seek the most appropriate legal drafting. And then, memory, if it serves us well, South Africa has not been involved in wars. Where we have sent troops is in a peacekeeping capacity. And then the need for some clarity on the issue of mercenaries has arisen in the context that a number of South Africans are engaged, for one, in Iraq. When they take up employment there, it's in a capacity when they advertise in newspapers as security officers and some other descriptions. But quite a number of them, when they arrive in those countries, the security operations are such that they actually find themselves directly involved in the conflicts there. And then others, I must add, they go knowing that they are going to fight for a particular side. So those engaged in mercenary activities. So there's that distinction there. And then also for us to remember where it has had a call on the country to respond to such activities is in the unfortunate situation where a number of individuals who find themselves in those countries are killed in those conflicts. And then family members here, the first port of call obviously is to say that South Africa, please assist in getting my husband, my son back and what have you. So as government, you can't wash your hands and say that no, they were involved in some mercenary activity. Whether you like it or not, those officials have to engage in that process. So I'm sure the broader aim here is to seek to guide the relevant officials how to deal with these issues. So all the issues that members are raising here, it's part of the challenge that department, state law advisors and everyone has, the legal drafting. Welcome, ma'am. I promise you we have not dealt with the issues that you wanted to speak on so passionately. You'll still get that opportunity. Thanks, good folks. If there's anything directly you want to respond to or comment you make in terms of what my colleague has said, please feel free to do so.
Thanks, Chair. I think we can only say we'll go back and rework the wording with the state advisors to get to that exact meaning of what that loss is intending to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And just maybe to add to that as well, the intention is if we say that the government of the Republic does not, so obviously it has to come from Cabinet, there has to be some other way, there must be a pronunciation whether we support this war or not. I think that is what we say is, that means support. I mean, your highest authority in the country, that's where we take our cue from. I think that was the intention behind the draft, that the government of the Republic of South Africa does not support. But we will further engage on that specific matter, Chair. Thanks.
I might just say that, Ed, that obviously the question of a war is a grave issue. It's normally not within the ambit of any minister to be able to decide on that. It's only your state president who is the commander-in-chief of the South African National Defense Force. And even that commander-in-chief can't take a decision as an individual. So also the laws that we seek to frame here are such that they should not and would not give carte blanche to any minister to just decide willy-nilly. The law is framed in such a manner that it should guide all. Person given responsibility over a certain period is simply that, but the intention can never be to empower some individual to make reckless decisions that have consequences for the rest of this country. Thank you. That.
Thank you, Jefferson. Now, I would like to hear, besides the reworking of the particular section, what is the view? Because the current situation now, as it stands, is that if the country does not support the war in a particular country, then the minister, on his or her discretion, would then grant or refuse, or then recommend particular, you know, punishment or withdraw completely the citizenship. Now, if you look at the Constitution, Section 10 and 11, everyone that is in this country has the right to dignity and the right to life, and once you remove the citizenship, that is taken away from you. You are like a corpse alive in the country. So there's so many implications, really. And I'm sure lawyers for human rights and everybody else, even the Human Rights Commission, and us sitting here is making those laws. So it is important that, taking into account the assertion that you've made and the very good intentions, of course, that you also take note of what we're saying. And I think the chairperson has even took it further by trying to define where those powers rest. And they even go beyond that. You know, sometimes Parliament, as a legislative authority, it takes time to agree on something very simple, whether to send the troops or not, in a country where there should be a peacekeeping. But I'm sure you should be in a position to find a way that does not create a controversy on that particular section. Thank you, Chairperson.
Sir, thank you. This might not necessarily be the view of the department, but in my personal capacity, having looked at this provision, as you are correctly putting it, it's a broader issue which needs the policy taken from high above, like the head of the state, not necessarily the minister. And I foresee us dragging a lot if we still have this provision in the bill. So I would think we might need to park it from the bill if we want to move forward with other provisions that are contained. And now, I'm sure the bell that you're hearing, it's definitely not tea time. It's definitely waking up those who are feeling comfortable and drowsy, but I'm sure it's an indication for members of that esteemed upper house, the National Council of Provinces, to go and commence work at the civilized hour when the slaves have already started much earlier. Good folks, many views tabled here. We can continue.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We've taken all the comments on board, and obviously we'll go and relook that. The next issue deals with, it's still on Section 6, the loss of citizenship that we're dealing with, where it was indicated by the Law Society of South Africa, where Section 6.1b currently requires the ex-citizens to be, as they quote them, they must also have the citizenship of the affected country. Clause 6a does not provide for that safety net. Because we're saying that with the new inclusion of the paragraph C, there are different categories that have been created, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you must have dual citizenship of the other country. So I think that specific issue has been catered for. I just think it's been misquoted in my view. I don't know if there's anything that you want to add on that specific issue.
You know, this noise when we commenced in Parliament in 1994, there would have been justification for ringing the bells of the upper house several times, because then we had stately people of advanced age who had to be reminded and called more often. But that's no longer the case. They are all sprightly. So we'll have to bear with whoever is playing with that bell. Somebody might have taken their daughter or son to work. We are in your able hands, good folks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. It's still on Clause 6, which deals with the loss of citizenship. Was the whole issue, I think this is where it comes, that no citizen, where they're quoting Section 20 of the Bill of Rights, where we're saying no citizen may be deprived of his or her citizenship. But if you look at the founding provisions as well, there is something prior in the Constitution that says in Section 2 that indicates, you know, you have to take, there must be national legislation that provides for loss and retention, etc. So you have got the authority to decide on certain areas where a person would lose his citizenship, his or her citizenship, where they would retain it, etc. And obviously going further then, Section 36 of the Constitution would come into play, where you must have, which is the limitation clause, where you must have law of general application. Well, because none of the rights in the Bill of Rights are absolute, so you can limit those rights, certain of those rights. I mean, right to life, I mean, that is absolute. You can't change that. So it's not that all of them are absolute, but most of them are. So if you can apply Section 3, and this is precisely, I think, what we're doing with the South African Citizenship Amendment, it's law of general application. And in certain instances, if somebody engages in a war, etc., and say in this specific scenario, it's somebody that's a South African citizen, and prior to engaging in such a war against the government, does not obtain authorization from the minister to retain his or her citizenship, that person will lose in terms of law of general application. So that's how we basically phrase that. We know that they're referring to Section, and in our view, this will then pass constitutional muster, as far as we can. But I mean, the state law advisors are also here to provide assistance in this regard, if there's difference from us.
Matizole, the last time you were within my ranks as a member of parliament, now you are raising your hand as the state law advisor. But as they say, a day is a very long time in politics. So is a minute, you see. Some men have woken up the president, and by the afternoon they are no longer the president. So I wouldn't be surprised if the same applies to members. State law advisor.
Thank you, Chair. Well, obviously state law advisors will certify the bill as being constitutional, so we are sure that the bill is constitutional. That is, but saying that, it is our opinion. An opinion is just that, an opinion. There are no, at the moment, constitutional court cases dealing with this type of issue, so we need to look further. I agree with as Victor Erasmus, the only thing is we, in the state law advisors, we see this is not as a deprivation, because what the bill says is you must be loyal to the country if you're a citizen. We say if you go and engage in the war, you're going to lose your citizenship. So it is not the government that takes away the citizenship. It's a voluntary act of going to fight whilst you know you're going to lose your citizenship. So you're losing your citizenship as a result of a voluntary act on your part. If that then doesn't is constitutional, then the second thing is, as Advocate Jerosma says, you can limit, and it is this, in an open and democratic society, either you want your citizens to be loyal, so you can then, in terms of a law of general application, limit certain rights, and in this instance, if you fight in wars that is not supported, you can lose your citizenship.
Baie dankie. The Honorable Masizole, Member of Parliament.
Thank you, Chairperson. The latter comments does not take away the initial submission that we ought to be looking at this very closely. Because the more we talk about it, the more we open up, and sometimes without knowing, there are some, you know, there are some gaps that are further exposed that we should be looking at. So I'm sure that the less we talk about this particular section of the bill, the better. So that we then hear these comments in writing and look at the way that they could phrase it, in order to accommodate our fears as this particular portfolio committee. But that's my view, Chair. I would have said something different before the state law advisor, but he has said so many things that are taking us back to my original submission earlier. So I guess it's better if we park this particular engagement until they give us the report on the own written submission as the department. I'm sure I'll be satisfied.
Thank you, member. Just to say that we have expressed opinions in regard to this. So I don't want us to give the impression that the less we say about this, the better. If it's we have flagged the gravity of the implications, and also what the state law advisor has just said, is that what makes this issue also particularly difficult is that there is no case law from the present constitutional court on this. So it's an area there that's sensitive because of all the reasons that all of you have cited. So we bear that in mind, and everybody will seek to do the best that they can by this. Eddie, you'll have to find the person that goes by the head of Parliamentary Law Advisor. She or he, I would also like to hear their views. We know that there's a great demand on the state law advisor, parliamentary law advisor. The last time a horrendous figure was cited, that there are about 5 or 8 to 50 portfolio committees, portfolio and select committees, which is a very untenable situation. So we'll have to speak to the authorities concerned. Speaker and everybody else, you see. If we are to do our work properly here, we need to be properly resourced with the relevant expertise. And the fortunate thing about lawyers, I've not seen any lawyer with two hands. They normally have on the other hand. So they give you many hands. That being the case, we'll continue with the many hands that we have here. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. Another issue that was raised with regard to Section 6.1, specifically A, is the phrase voluntary and formal act, and what does that specifically mean? But what we're saying in this regard is, other than a mention, in other words, you avail yourself, you acquire the citizenship or nationality of another country. So we can't prescribe for another country, and we're looking specifically at 6.1a. What would be a voluntary and formal act? If you want to apply for citizenship of another country, there would be processes that you need to have, forms that you need to complete, etc. That would be a voluntary and a formal act, and anything that you can produce in this regard that would indicate to us that you've done that, obviously, in our view, would be a voluntary and formal act. That was just one of the issues that was raised, and I said that we should define voluntary informal act, but it's very difficult. Are you going to tell another government, listen, there must be a form that must be written out, etc.? You can't legislate on behalf of other governments. That's our view in that specific regard. Thanks, Chair. If I may proceed. Once again, exclusion from the loss of citizenship that was raised here, the issue of marriage. If you look at loss of citizenship, it says there, any formal, voluntary informal act other than marriage. So in other words, marriage is not seen as impeding in this regard. The legislation, Section 618, refers to marriage as an exclusion to the loss of South African citizenship through the acquisition of dual nationality. Now, their submission is that either the amendment book can conform that the acquisition of foreign citizenship by marriage is excluded from loss of citizenship under Section 6, no matter whether the process undertaken is a voluntary or formal act, or this exclusion should be removed altogether to avoid confusion on this issue, or further, that the term formal and voluntary should be suitably defined. But I think I've already addressed that and said it has always been there, it's never been an issue at this point in time. And our view is that it should stay. You should still exclude marriage or use marriage as an exclusion in this regard.
Thank you. I just wanted to remind members that the law advisor from the department is still answering or speaking to the submission by the Law Society of South Africa. So you are able to follow the relevant clause that is speaking to by just referencing that particular submission. And I thank the one who closed the door. Some Holy Spirit entered, or evil spirit opened the door and closed it again. But we'll continue without the divine intervention.
Thanks, Chair. I think the paragraph 3.3 on page 9 of the submission of the South African Law Society, there's a submission that the amendment bill should make the necessary provision for the measures and to protect those ex-citizens who have already obtained permanent residence in South Africa by this route. I think what it deals with here, and I stand to be clear, is where there's a time that if somebody has left the country, now they haven't been here for, they've lost their citizenship because of a voluntary act. So they're out of the country, or they've lost that citizenship for 2 years or three. Now they apply for retention thereof. Now what then happens is they want that period for which they had lost their citizenship, that should be calculated and be taken into consideration, as that you actually have not lost that citizenship if the minister grants it again. Sorry, Chair. I'm at another point.
Sorry, I think Advocate Erasmus has went further to another point. Just to assist, this point deals with the issue where the loss of citizenship, as they put it, the Law Society says, if you lose citizenship, you revert to permanent residence. And that shouldn't be the case. Because if you are a citizen, you are now fully, and if you lose citizenship, you have totally lost everything. So you cannot regain what enabled you to gain citizenship. So I think this is the issue. And we're saying currently, as is, that's how we understand it. But I think Mr. Singer might assist in if there's he has got a different practice. We follow a different practice that if you lose citizenship, you revert to permanent residence, but that shouldn't be the case. Thank you.
Chair, that's an interpretation, I think it's of Section 13 of the Act, Resumption of South African Citizenship, 13.3. Where it's read to mean that if a former citizen by birth or descent that loses or that has lost South African citizenship such person then retains the right to permanent residence. But it's taken a further step, that right must be exercised, so normally it would be required that they now foreign passport be stamped with a permit showing that they've got a permanent resident status to allow them then access into the country and out of the country. But if it's a former citizen by naturalization that has lost citizen, such person is not regarded to have a permanent resident status, and the only way that in case of resumption, such person must go through the process of naturalization again before they can apply for naturalization, or in terms of section 13.4, is that in, yeah, it's 13.4, I just have to check, it's one of those sections there where they then can apply for exemption from that requirement. But the basic approach is that if it's a former citizen by birth or descent, such person retains the right to permanent residence. I think that's the distinction, and it's how we apply it currently.
Thank you. You still find members. If you are fine, then it means I have to be fine. We may proceed, Advocate.
Thanks, Jay. Thank
you, Chairperson. Now, the second issue relates to the loss of citizenship and resumption. I think the submission deals with the person whether if a person has lost citizenship today, 5 days down the line or 5 years down the line, the person applies for resumption, what happens to the vacuum? Does it mean that you are a citizen until today, but the period of 5 years in between, you were not a citizen? When you resume, you don't go back as if you were a citizen all along. And I stand to be corrected by line function here, because our understanding is, as legal services, if you have lost citizenship today and you resume after 5 years, the period of vacuum, you are not a citizen, so the resumption doesn't go back to the day as if you had never lost citizenship, but I'll stand to be corrected. So for us is there no benefit that you are getting within that vacuum? Yes. So if you treat us even if you have lost citizenship, so we don't see any benefits for that, but I think I'll request Mr. Kritzinger to assist me on the interpretation that we have as legal services. Thank you.
Chair, the interpretation by legal services in terms of the effective date is correct. Resumption takes effect from the date of approval of the resumption application. That is correct. But there's a section 26.4 where there can be restoration of citizenship in a specific circumstance, and basically that section was brought into the legislation to cater for persons that automatically lost South African citizenship before the implementation of the 1995 Act as we have it now, because of acquiring the citizenship of another country by a formal and voluntary act. Now, section 26.4 specifically provides that if you then granted restoration, you would be regarded as never to have lost. So you're put back in the position as if you never lost. But that was to cater for a specific category of people. It was basically people that had to leave the country during the apartheid years and then acquired the citizenship of another country, and in the process then obviously lost their citizenship. And when they returned to South Africa, when the new government came into operation, to then put them back in the position as if they've never lost. So it was to cater for a specific category of persons at the time. Now, this one, it's then open for debate whether it should cover that period, but as we interpret it currently, you resume today, it's approved today, it takes effect from today.
Thank you very much. The exception to the rule, as it were, that you have explained, seems to make sense. and the other provision that if you have lost it for a certain period, then you can't say during the period that you had lost it, saying that it should kick into force. It sounds logical. When you were talking about that aspect, it reminded me of my bank manager. He will say, Matthews, there's no money in this account. Service this account. So would I be able to go back to the bank manager and say that, imagine there was money in the account during the period that you said you wanted funds in my account. So it's a difficult one. But then, I do not want to digress with the love-hate relationship with my bank manager. There you have it, good folks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The next issue that we looked in deals with the issue of foreign passports. And what the Law Society indicated here, this is something they mentioned, there are numerous South Africans that take up foreign passports in South Africa with no intention of ever actually leaving South Africa to reside abroad permanently, whether as a result of family or ancestral linkages. The issue that we have here, if you're going to leave the country, and I need to be corrected here, Bala, if you need to be either a South African citizen or a permanent resident to be able to have a South African passport. And I would surely think that that is also the case in other countries. Before you can have a passport of another country, you must either be a citizen or some of the permanent resident, etc. We can't legislate on behalf of other countries, as we said. So, obviously, South Africa allows dual citizenship. However, if that other country does not allow dual citizenship, the indication on the bill is as well that you have to first renounce the citizenship of the other country before you take up the citizenship of South Africa.
Any comment on that, members, if it's... No comment, and then we'll move forward.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm also going to hand over to my colleague now as well to deal with the submission of CRI. That was the Law Society of South Africa, a submission that we dealt with. I'm just going to hand over to my colleague to deal with the CRI submission. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members. The submission on the South African Citizenship Amendment Bill by Citizenship Rights Africa Initiative firstly deals with citizenship by birth, and it is in line with the proposal or suggested or comments made by BASOP relating to children who are born in the Republic, that any child born in the Republic should have citizenship, rights to citizenship as by birth. And what we have in the bill, just a second, is that we have created a clause that says the child who is born in the Republic, firstly of South Africans, will automatically acquire citizenship by birth. But if the child is born of persons who are permanent residents, that child would, at the age of 18, decide if that he or she does not have any citizenship that can be taken up by the child. Then the second category will be cases where children who are born in the Republic, of persons who are merely admitted into the Republic, not for permanent residence, to be able to take up citizenship at the age of 18. Also, they will have to decide, but that should be the cases where they are unable to take citizenship of another country. Also, provision is made for those children who would more or less not have any citizenship, any claim of citizenship of any other country. So we're saying, as we presented or made a presentation in the first briefing, that the situation where any child born in the Republic would have to gain the right of citizenship is not an issue that we are looking at currently.
but perhaps in the future, if at all, that should come to that point. So generally, that will be the issue, and also that will address the concerns, the comments made by PASOP in relation to this issue. Then, on page 2 of the submission, there is reference to the law section 2.2, which during, Chairperson, as the Chair might remember, during our presentation, we had indicated that we would want to delete under clause 2, the subsection 2, as it creates a bit of confusion. So that was still stand by that we would want to delete that subsection 2. And the consequence thereof will be that under clause 2, the subsection 3, we would then have to amend it as a consequence to remove subsection 2 appearing in line 53. The 2 there should be 1. So we'll indicate that in writing also. And we'll discuss with the table advisors in relation to that. Then, if I may proceed, Chair, the issue that is raised also is in relation to the new subsection 4 under clause 2, which will be section 2.4. That still relates to any person born in the Republic of parents who have been admitted into the Republic. The same argument relating to any child born in the Republic should outrightly get South African citizenship. And while still there, that is also the based on the comments made by Powers for Human Law Society of South Africa, that is the clause that we said we are going to align with the other clause 4. Then going forward, if I may proceed, there is just a recommendation which I think we've dealt with, that it was saying they recommend that we amend subsections 2.4 and 4.3 that are drafted simply to provide for a child born in the Republic who is still resident there at majority to qualify for citizenship by birth and have the right to apply for recognition of status of that majority that we've dealt with. Just going to page 3, the submission deals with citizenship by naturalization. And it talks to the issue that we talked to in the Law Society relating to continuous period and the period of ordinary residence. To say, they are saying, they understand that the requirement of 5 years continuous residence should be clarified, because it cannot surely mean that a person cannot travel out of the country at all during the period. So that will address that clarity will be indicated in terms of what does ordinary mean, and if someone has left the Republic for a particular period, will that negatively affect the running of the period, which we are saying it should not. Then the other issue, still on page 3 of the submission, deals with citizenship by descent. And the submission says, the proposed new section 3 of citizenship provides that an adopted person should be a citizen by descent rather than citizen by birth. And then and they are indicating that the current act provides that children born out of the Republic are currently regarded as citizens by descent, but that is being removed. That we are confirming that the whole category of descent will be those children who are adopted. Then it says there appears to be no difference between the rights and responsibilities of citizens by birth and citizens by descent. So the separate category adds unnecessary confusion, while the whole point of legal act adoption is to put the child under the same position as natural child. But I think that we agree that there will be no difference in terms of the rights between a child who acquired citizenship by birth and that that child who has acquired citizenship by descent. But although I think it is necessary to create that distinction in terms of the acquisition of citizenship. Then on page 4, the next issue that the submission deals with is birth registration. It just, I'll read it, it just says sections 2, 3 and 4 and section 43 of the Citizenship Act as amended apply to children born in South Africa who would not otherwise have a nationality and to children born in South Africa who are still resident there at majority. It provides that they need to register their birth in terms of the Birth and Death Registration Act 1992. It says, while at first sight this seems a reasonable requirement, CRAD is concerned that it may in practice exclude many children who should be eligible for citizenship by birth in South Africa. think our response there to is that the main focus is that, and with the campaign that the department is coming up with, that children must be registered at the age, within the period of 30 days. We cannot be creating exclusions to other children. For example, children of permanent residents or foreigners who are temporarily residing in the country, that they should be allowed not to register within the period of 30 days. Currently, the process is, as and when they register their birth, they are called in the population register, and they are able to be they're issued with an abridged birth certificate, which are handwritten currently. Then, for the purpose of those who would want to go back to their own countries to register their birth, they are able to do so at ease. And this is the same requirement we have for South African children who are born outside the Republic. They need to register their birth in the particular country where birth occurred, so that when they come or they can go to admission, then we are able to put them on the population register. So we cannot create a different category wherein we allow people not to register within a period of 30 days, because we would like to have everyone who lives in the Republic of South Africa to be properly documented, either through Immigration Act or the Birth and Death Registration Act. Then, going further on page 5, there's an issue of dual nationality. And this also deals with Section 6. I think we've already dealt much with Section 6 with regard to the, I think there is almost similar issues. But maybe I can just read through the context in which they raise this particular issue. They say that the proposed addition of a new requirement to the section dealing with citizenship by naturalization, that a person applying must satisfy the minister that they are either a citizen of a country that allows dual nationality. And the issue that they're raising is that this is going to raise issues when it comes to refugees. And they're saying, as an example, children of Somali nationals who have fled to South Africa and were born in South Africa may wish to apply for naturalization as South Africans. Another proposed section 43, if unamended, if they are still resident in South Africa at a majority, they are saying it is not reasonable to require them to provide proof that they have renounced Somali citizenship, which they are likely to never have had formal recognition of, even if they were entitled to it in theory. And I think the case that we are making is with regard to children is that if a child is born in the Republic and lives in the Republic from birth to attaining the age of majority, being 18 years, there will not be issues of renunciation of a citizenship of another country, because they have never had that citizenship or claim to the citizenship. So the issue of renunciation will not come into the picture. Then, going forward, the next issue being raised, still on page 5, deals with loss and deprivation of citizenship. I think it's almost the same issues that are being raised or that have been raised by the Law Society of South Africa. But just to indicate a few of the issues that they're raising is that Parliament should delete the proposed addition of a new ground in section on loss of citizenship, the addition 6.1c, that is the issue relating to war, fighting under the in a war under the flag of another country. I think that we have dealt with adequately, and as we said, we are going to address it and come back to the portfolio committee on that. The other issue that has been raised is that Section 6 and 8 should also provide specific protection against making a person stateless, in line with the UN Convention on the Reduction of Stateless, to which South Africa is not yet a party. The law should provide that a person cannot lose their nationality if they would therefore become stateless. But I think, as I gave the example, that would not in any way make sure that children who are born in the Republic become stateless. They would obviously acquire citizenship at the age of 18. And the rest of the document from page 6, it just deals with the UN Convention on Statelessness, which we are not yet a party to it. And it goes further to explain the Citizenship Rights Africa Initiative. I mean, it's more or less issues that are outside the bill, which are just too general, dealing with examples of other what other African states are providing for other their citizenship acts. Also dealing with the rights to nationality in other countries. So we find it that we would not deal much with this because that's just general information that might be useful, but not for the purpose of today. Then our the next submission, Chair and members, honorable members, comes from the Lawyers for Human Rights.
Perhaps before you go to the next submission, any comments, questions? If there are none, I would like to beg the indulgence of the House and suggest a 10-minute break. There are people who came in very fresh here, they are flagging. And I must just share with the House, I once chaired one of these meetings, and somebody fell asleep, and their false teeth fell out. It was a bit embarrassing. So we don't have control over our bodily functions when we drift into sleep. So I wouldn't like to have such an occasion again. So I'm not the cheapest one, so it's 6 minutes past 11. Could we kindly resume at about 11:15? Unfortunately, I'm told the chairperson's budget is so poorer than a church mouse. I can't even say there's fresh coffee outside. So I have to make do and be innovative and speak about iced coffee and iced tea. Sounds very upmarket, but it's poverty. Thank you, folks. Can you close that door? We can continue, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Advocate Sabella Mecha will continue. Now, I just want to, on the bill itself, before we lose that, on page 5, that obviously it deals with citizenship by birth and clause 4. So it's going to be section 2.4 of the Act. It says that any person born in the Republic of parents who have been admitted into the Republic. And our view is there's wording missing there. There should be into the Republic for permanent residence. Otherwise, you come into the country for permanent residence, but you're not a South African citizen. So anybody or any child born of a permanent resident in the country then will qualify for citizenship if he has been living in the country from the date of birth to the date of attaining the age of majority, and that birth has been registered in the Birth and Death Registration Act, in terms of that act. It's on page 5 of the bill. Page 5 of the bill, before we go to the submission. Page 5, the first, that clause 4 there, sub-clause 4. So, in the second line, after the word Republic, we're just going to include the words into the Republic for permanent residence. So in other words, it's speaking to your permanent resident issues. If we go, and the reason why I want to mention this is if you go down to citizenship by naturalization, under clause 4, section 4.3 says, a child born in the Republic of parents who are not South African citizens or who have not been admitted into the Republic for permanent residence. So it's just the naturalization one. So they're not a permanent resident. and neither are they South African citizens, that child qualifies on the same grounds, A and B. The birth must be registered, and upon attaining the age of 18 years, that's right. Just for clarity purposes. Thanks, Chief. I can hand over to Anne Simonovich. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members. I'm now going to deal with the submission by Lawyers for Human Rights. On page 1 of the submission, actually it should be page 2 because page 1 is the cover, under the introduction and explanation of the need for insertion of provisions on stateless persons, the submission goes on to deal with the issue of the definition under section 1(1) of the Children's Act of 2005, and says a child is an orphan if he or she is a child who has no surviving parent caring for him or her, and a child is abandoned if he or she A, has obviously been deserted by the parent, guardian or caregiver, or B, has no apparent reason, had no contact with the parent, guardian or caregiver for a period of at least 3 months. This lays the basis for the comment that is being made under paragraph 2, paragraph 1, subparagraph 2. Then it says, though the bill appears to make provision for otherwise stateless children born within South Africa's borders, and that reference is made to the substitute section 2(3), which is under clause 2 of the bill, under citizenship by birth. Then they further say, LHR is concerned that no similar provision exists for naturalization of stateless child who is born outside of South Africa and who subsequently find themselves in the country. I'm now dealing with clause 2, which is on page 4, going to subsection, it will be 2(3). And the concern raised is that if there's any child who is born outside the Republic and happens to find himself in the Republic or herself as unaccompanied, orphaned or abandoned child, and they are making it clear that those are obviously vulnerable individuals and they will have no protection of the state or the care of the responsible adult. Therefore, the suggestion is that we need to cater for them being able to acquire citizenship. But our submission would be that any person who would be unaccompanied, orphaned or abandoned would be dealt with in terms of the Immigration Act, wherein a proper permit after investigation has been done with the cooperation of the Department of Social Development, establishing the circumstances under which a child has been found. And also within the provisions of the Refugees Act, there is a provision that deals with unaccompanied children who appear or minors who are found in those circumstances that clearly says they have got no one to take care of them, wherein they will be assisted by the Department of Social Development to firstly to establish whether indeed there is no any other person in the Republic who is going to be able to take care of them. Secondly, if they are children who are in need of protection under the Refugees Act, they will be properly assisted to make an application. And if at all the child would have to be dealt with in terms of the Immigration Act, there will be other proper measures that the department is going to apply, working together with the Department of Social Development. And most definitely, also in terms of the Birth and Death Registration Act, there is a provision that deals with children who are orphaned. I think there will be proper registration of that child as a foreigner in terms of the Birth and Death Registration Act. Therefore, our argument is that we are not necessarily going to grant citizenship. There are other acts that are applicable before the Citizenship Act that one would have to assist the children under which. Then in paragraph 2, still on page 2, the submission goes on to deal with the provisions of the international law supporting legislation against statelessness, of which we are not yet a part. But the argument that is brought under page 3 is that though South Africa has not acceded to either of these conventions, which is the Khartoum Declaration of OEU Ministerial Meeting on Refugees, Return is an internally displaced person in Africa, Khartoum Declaration exhorts its members, including South Africa, to accede to both the 1954 Convention and the 1961 Convention.
Furthermore, South Africa is a party to two League of Nations protocols regarding statelessness that both seeks to provide nationalities with otherwise stateless persons. They're saying in all these ways, international law strongly supports national provisions for the naturalization of stateless persons to ease their burdens and allow them to participate as full members of societies. As I've already indicated, there are other provisions that we can use other than directly going under Citizenship Act and granting citizenship that we can use to assist those persons who find themselves stateless currently. Then in paragraph 3, the submission deals with national and international law regarding protection of children. And the submission goes to say, LHR is concerned about the absence of protection for stateless, unaccompanied, orphaned, and abandoned children. And it says, LHR sees the need for protection of foreign children through naturalization, even when their parents are not South African permanent residents or naturalized citizens. I think this we have made a case with regard to those children who are born in the Republic, that they will be able to get citizenship while they have attained the age of 18, and otherwise, before that, the Immigration and the Refugees Act will come into place to assist them. A further case is made by reference to Section 28(2) of the South African Constitution that says a child's best interests are of paramount importance in every matter concerning the child, and says likewise the Children's Act states that in all matters concerning the care, protection and well-being of a child, the standard that the child's best interest is of paramount importance must be applied. But we still argue that we have other laws that will cater for the children other than directly granting citizenship. And of course, when we deal with such children, we are going to use the Children's Act, which provides for assistance by social workers, and we are going to make an investigation and recommendation, and we'll be working with them so we'll be able to properly assist those children. And another paragraph is paragraph 4 that still talks to the stateless in the proposed legislation. I think this we have adequately dealt with, but it however says South Africa clearly already recognizes the problem of statelessness, as the newly proposed law does give one avenue for citizenship for a stateless person. As subsection 3A makes clear, the bill makes provision for the stateless child born within the Republic, and I think this is the argument that we are already saying, that we are not necessarily staying behind and saying we're not going to do anything, but we are saying only those children who are born in the Republic until the age of 18 will be considered directly for citizenship. However, I think the argument which is misinterpreted that they're making is still under paragraph 4. They're saying, however, the legislation is unreasonably burdensome to stateless children where it proposes new rules for naturalization. Specifically, section 43A requires inter alia that stateless children have been present in South Africa from birth in order to become a naturalized citizen. But our argument here is that if a child is stateless and is born in the Republic, up until the age of 18, if that child is stateless, would not be able to travel to any other country because they would not have no claim to any other nationality of the other country. So I think the argument is a bit misinterpreted in that way, in our understanding. Then there is a recommendation made by the Lawyers for Human Rights with regard to the wording to be inserted in the bill. It says, LHR recommends that the following provision be inserted into the bill in order to grant, that is on page 5. LHR recommends that the following provision be inserted into the bill in order to grant citizenship to an orphaned or abandoned child born outside South Africa, as well as to an unaccompanied child who does not have the protection of any other state. The wording I'm going to read will go as follows. A child born outside of the Republic to parents who are not South African citizens or who have not been admitted into the Republic for permanent residence is eligible to apply for South African citizenship, (1) if he or she became orphaned or abandoned within the Republic, provided he or she does not have the citizenship or the right to claim the citizenship of another state. 2) If the child is unaccompanied and does not have the protection or the right to claim the protection of another state, then what will follow, I think, will be another subsection that says the child will be entitled to remain legally in the country even after the age of majority if an application for citizenship
has been lodged until the application for citizenship has been finalized. I think our comment here will be that if we look at, for example, the proposal in paragraph A, what will be paragraph A? It says, if he or she became orphaned or abandoned within the Republic. But then the question that we'll have to have is, what is an orphaned and abandoned child? And I thought the case that they're making is that the child will be in the Republic without any other person. But then if a child is abandoned, it means someone is abandoning them. But the case that we'll have to deal with is, this child will be in the Republic. At what stage would the child have been abandoned? Would it be while he's outside the Republic? Wouldn't they, if that is the case, wouldn't they fall under unaccompanied, that they came into the Republic without company? But then, like I indicated, if the child will be in the circumstances that clearly says the child requires protection under the Refugees Act as an asylum seeker, there is a provision that deals adequately with that. And if the child clearly is not within the circumstances that would be falling within the Refugees Act, the Immigration Act will be will come into place, and minister has got the power, is granted the power to grant exemption from compliance with particular requirements that the child could get a permit or a permanent residence under the Immigration Act. So we believe that the Immigration Act and the Refugees Act will adequately deal with the situation, and the other situation is catered for where the child is born within the Republic until the age of 18. And I think the what follows thereafter is just the case in reference to the statistics that are given relating to orphans, as estimated by United Nations Children's Fund, the UNICEF. I think that will be the end of the submission by the lawyers for human rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Advocate. Die eerbare lede, enige kommentaar, vraag is vry. Die eerbare meneer Masizole.
Thank you, Sir President. When the lawyers for human rights presented their case, we had ample time to engage them, and I'm sure the department in response is even taking it further. And I must say I'm happy to hear that the manner in which you have dealt with this is responding to each one of these paragraphs, because one of the arguments which I also picked up, Chair, is that for instance, if you look on paragraph 4, the second paragraph there, in that page, is that the assumption there is that the current rule which is being proposed, let me just quote this, that however the legislation is unreasonably burdensome to stateless children where it proposes new rules for naturalization. I think for whatever reasons that the assertion that they made was giving was making an assumption that if you look at clause two, number 4A, is that if you look at naturalization, for those who have been born outside South Africa should also qualify. I mean, the reality here is that if you remember our argument, in fact, I made this argument that if you have people that are going to come with children and dump them in South Africa and then leave, knowing that obviously this child, when they get to the age of 18, then they're going to be naturalized. It makes the country a very lawless kind of a country, because we're going to end up having so many people coming into the country as young, and then later on they are then given status to be South Africans. So this one specifically addresses the issue that all of us are concerned, I'm hoping, that children who are born here who find themselves without parents, even if they are born by parents from New Zealand, from Ghana, from wherever, those are our children. So the other issue which I had concerns about, in fact, it's not on this particular bill, it's on the other bill, but they interlink because we're dealing with issues of natural, I mean, issues of citizenship. It's when people would come in a boat or whatever, you remember this issue, and then because they are privileged, they have resources, then they give birth in a boat or in a ship, wherever. And then because it's in the sea, and then we seem to take responsibility for that and say, no, they are South Africans. And I'm hoping that when we deal with it at that stage, we'll be able to have dealt with that in a more convincing way. But I support the department in this particular one, I'm sure. Because there's been some other organizations, being true or not, who, for whatever reasons, who seem to be wanting to compel the department to accept the view of their customers. Let me be very honest here. If you have stakeholders or you have members who seem to be more foreign, then you'll obviously try to make sure that you serve them best. But we are here observing the Constitution, and I'm sure there's no way where we will be undermining the Constitution as a supreme document that should guide us as we live. So I wanted to make that point very seriously, because the argument from every particular organization that would come forward has always been mainly around that particular issue, even though they would twist it to suit themselves. But I think that one needs to be very much, we need to be very much emphatic and clear on that particular one.
Thank you very much, member. My only concern was when you said, let me be very honest here. I have the impression that you are consistently honest. Now you go ahead and qualify your honesty.
I've been very honest.
You are further qualifying it. If I was your legal counsel, I would advise you to leave that matter. Okay, I'm making the case worse. Thanks, member, on a serious note. The advocates, thank you. You have clearly articulated as to how you are engaging and addressing those issues. Thank you. We may proceed, good folks.
Chair, just to add on the issue of stateless children, etc., obviously we must keep in mind that we've also got the Children's Act that will also obviously play a very important role in how we deal with children that are stateless, abandoned, etc., in South Africa. So there are other pieces of it, just to link up with what Jesse said just now. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, once again, and honourable members. I'll now move to the submission by BASOP, which is People Against Suffering, Suppression, Oppression and Poverty. On page one, there's an overview which I feel it would not go to it, but there's a subheading talking to grant citizenship at birth. This is the same argument that has been raised by CRY, which we are saying will only grant citizenship, as contained in the bill, citizenship at birth to those children who are born within the categories we've mentioned, not to every child who is just born in the Republic as they propose it. Because they go on to say, currently South African law dictates citizenship exclusively through the citizenship of one's parents and not by the location of one's birth when determining the nationality of someone born inside of the RSA. It says these two concepts are not mutually exclusive. They refer to that we need to incorporate into South African law a guiding principle alongside the granting of citizenship to anyone born in the Republic, regardless of citizenship of either both or his or parents. But I think we would want to maintain our argument that a child born of a South African citizen, either in or outside the Republic, will automatically get a South African citizenship. And within the categories that we've mentioned, that those children who are born of parents who
permanent residents would, at the age of 18, exercise the right to take up citizenship if they've got no claim to any other citizenship, and also catering for those children who would be born of parents who are admitted even for temporary residence in the Republic. And going further to page 2, I think they are giving examples of the legal application of the principle where a child who is born in the Republic outrightly gets citizenship, and they refer to Canada, Brazil, and they also indicate the intended impact for children, and they are saying children, no matter where they are born, are a vulnerable group that requires more support and attention than adults. Those born to refugees and asylum seeker parents are even more vulnerable, as they lack the protection and the rights offered by residents in the country where their parents have citizenship. And with regard to this, our comment would be that, for example, children who are born of refugees, they automatically get what we call a derivative status of refugee. So they are given protection by the Republic while they are still refugees. And if a person who is still an asylum seeker has made an application and is still awaiting adjudication and happens to give birth to a child in the Republic, the child should be registered, as I indicated, in terms of the Birth and Death Registration Act, and they will be given a handwritten, unabridged birth certificate, so that we have got record that a child is born. And it is upon, in the Refugees Act, there is a provision that says within, and this is in the Amendment Act, that within a period of 30 days, they must register and also ensure that they register the child, or make sure that their application is amended to include the child, so that when their status is granted, it's automatically granted to the child also. And I think they furthermore go on to refer to the conventions on rights of the child in their submission. But I think I'll move on to the next page, 3, wherein they deal with the heading. The heading says standardized naturalization time requirements. This will deal with clause 5, that amends section 5, relating to the continuous period of residence. And they go on to say, right now, those seeking citizenship through naturalization are required to live in the RSA as a permanent resident for 1 year prior to an application, and a total of 4 years in the previous 8 years. And this is at clause 5, at paragraph, just to get to the right paragraph, at paragraph C, on page 5 of the bill. And they go on to say, the proposed amendment Act seeks to change this to require five continuous years of permanent residence prior to applying. And it further says, this requirement mirrors what is required of refugees who wish to apply for permanent residence as detailed in the Refugees Amendment Act of 2008. And this means a refugee must live in the RSA for a minimum period of 10 years, most likely to be accrued consecutively before being eligible for naturalization. The proposed legislation should consider the time person spends as an asylum seeker and a refugee as equivalent to that of a permanent resident, thus matching the number of years required for naturalization eligible to that which is required of permanent residents. Here, what the submission says is that if a person has applied for asylum, and this person perhaps will take 2 years to finalize the application, that period of 2 years should be considered whenever there is an application for citizenship, so that we do not only start counting from the time that the person became a refugee, which they will take 5 years to become permanent residents, then go on to calculate another 5 years. So, but we are saying that should not be the case. And I think the issue, if I remember, Chairperson also slightly addressed the issue during the presentation that was made by PASOP, to say that if the department perhaps is currently taking a period of 6 months to adjudicate a case, it should not be necessarily affecting other provisions, but we should work on making sure that the department, and of which we are working towards, we adjudicate cases timeously. So we should not work on the illness of a particular process to benefit to create benefit somewhere else, but we should rather make sure that things are done adequately on time. And I think the two paragraphs down the line, that's where they indicate that the Department of Home Affairs is currently unable to process asylum applications in the 180 days outlined in the Refugees Act, which is the issue that I just dealt with. Then the last paragraph on page 3 says,
I remember from the start we've been engaging from time to time during the presentation. If I may just bring to your attention, the attention of the speaker now. He makes the...
May I suggest that he just conclude that part which was related to it, and then we'll...
That's fine.
We'll take comments and questions. I'll indulge you then. In my view, I was just about to finish a portion that's linked to what he's saying. Master Zon.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm dealing with the last paragraph of page 3, which is the last paragraph on the item standardized naturalization time requirements. It says, I'll read briefly, by counting the years of living in the IC while under consideration for and after receiving refugee status towards fulfilling the time requirement for naturalization, the law will be standardized in how citizenship eligibility is applied to refugees and permanent residents. And it goes on to say, both categories of applicants will need to live in the RSA for 5 continuous years prior to submitting an application. And it says it will also accelerate a refugee's ability to restart and rebuild the life he or she was forced to leave behind upon fleeing his or her country of origin. So I think we still maintain the argument that we should stick to the correct time frames in dealing with applications for asylum. Then that shouldn't end up resulting in the benefit that we create in the Citizenship Act, that we reduce the number of periods for eligibility for citizenship to include the period which was spent whilst awaiting a decision. Thank you. That will be the end of this issue dealing with the time for naturalization.
Advocate, thank you. Honorable member?
Thank you, Chairperson. The temptation I had immediately when you mentioned that it takes 3 months to respond to an asylum seeker case, especially when it goes to other processes of applying for Section 24, as we know, and you know that it's not the case at present. Until the new operational structure is put in place, and how long, I mean, the current situation is such that now it's taking forever in practice, and many people are complaining about it. But because we're not regulating here, we're trying to make the act so that it becomes a sustainable act for a very long time. But you won't be able to, whenever there's a problem, you must now bring an act, try to bring a bill to Parliament and deal with a particular issue. But I would like to check now, in terms of dealing with the issue as it stands, how do you foresee reducing the timing, which doesn't take not a year, sometimes it takes 2 to 3 years, if not more, for one to be recognized as a refugee? How do you see that time being managed in such a way that the person could get this refugee status, if granted, at least within the prescribed term, in terms of the Constitution and the Act? Now, which is the problem is not necessarily with the Act itself, but it's also on the implementation side. So I can imagine a situation where we are saying that a person must only wait until you are given a refugee status, and then only then you are starting to apply, because that is what we are saying, without taking into account those burdens afterwards. So I'm sure, let us try to be cognizant of the fact that there are other factors in the bureaucratic process. Now, I would like to ask that question to be responded specifically on the current situation and possibly the one in the foreseeable future, with the influx of people in the SADC who come into the country as economic migrants who then tend to become asylum seekers. The last one, Chair, is the issue of the non-citizens who are here. What is the status of those children now as they are here who are non-citizens but they are in this country? What is the current norm that we apply to ensure that their rights and everything that should be serving them as citizens here is observed until they become the majors? I think it would be important to clarify that now if we have children who are at the age of 3 up to the age of 17, 18, this is the current situation and this is how we deal with them. Because I remember they tried to respond to it earlier, but it was only on the basis of studying. Now also the issue is, it can they travel without passports in order to ensure that whatever the situation is, other services could be rendered? Well, what is the situation there? I think that is important to try and outline for the benefit of the committee as to the overall servicing of those children. If they have to travel to their original countries, what is the process of applying for passports, for instance, if they do not have any documents? So I'm just wondering, based on the manner in which the presenters are putting it before us.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Any other comments? Masizole. I must say you had me worried when you started off and saying that you are tempted. And what came to mind is that it is said opportunity knocks once, temptation all the time. So you yielded to temptation. Good folks, you had the comments. It's a mixed basket of commentary and some questions. Any takers?
Thank you, Chairperson. We've noted the questions, but I'm not at ease to adequately address the issues of the turnaround times currently, because we do not have a specific person in line function. But I know there are measures that are being applied to deal with the issues of fast tracking of applications. I think that would perhaps maybe go back, take the question to the department and highlight it so that we get the relevant immigration branch, and just to get an update as to what is it that is being done.
But then, just on that, Advocate, before you move on to the other aspect that you want to raise, I think what the member does is to flag a very pertinent aspect. In drafting legislation, we should also be informed by the objective conditions that currently prevail, so that we don't come up with ideal laws that are in the clouds, but our feet are not on the ground, so that we must mitigate that balance. What's reality and what's the ideal? So the substance or the principal issue is that is flagging. Let us look at the objective conditions whilst we are drafting here as well. You may continue, sir. No. I'm not going to indulge you on that same issue. They've not yet answered you fully. I was just commenting, emphasizing that we shouldn't lose the aspect that you raised. So a little bit of patience.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. If I can try and just give a bit of background on the the first two questions, yes, there are indeed shortcomings. It takes a lot of, quite a long period of time in certain instances where an asylum application received and eventually granting refugee status, although it has been indicated that it's in a very small majority or small percentage that actually where the people are granted refugee status at the end of the time. But there is a systems problem. We need to put that up front. The systems within the department don't necessarily talk to each other. You've got your immigration system. Say, for instance, an asylum seeker enters the country through a port of entry and applies at one refugee reception center, moves to another refugee reception center because, say, for instance, his application was refused there, moves to another refugee reception center and apply under another name. The systems don't pick that up. What they've done now, they've also introduced fingerprinting. And I can indicate a case in the Eastern Cape that we picked up where there was a refugee, the status was, or asylum seeker, the status was not confirmed at the end of the day. The person was given, then obviously goes over to the Immigration Act, was given an order to leave the country as an illegal foreigner, voluntarily obviously. That person tried to come back into the system under another name. But when they put the fingerprints there, it picked up the person immediately, and then the person could be dealt with. So, yes, there are delays in this, but we are putting measures in place in order to try and address not only the corruption issues, but also to try and work on the turnaround times. With regard to the 90%, well, I would say 90% more or less, we've got a lot of economic migrants in the system as well, and the department is currently engaged in a process, a policy overview, in this regard and how to deal with economic migrants themselves that clogs the system. Those are the words that policy is still being worked on, and that will obviously come into effect, well, if I say come into, be brought to the Portfolio Committee and Cabinet at the end of the day once they have finalized that specific policy on how to deal with economic migrants vis-a-vis asylum seekers that are genuine asylum seekers and that would qualify for refugee status within the country. Just on those two issues, and I think then I can hand over to my colleagues on the more, the travelling without a passport, and if a child can travel without a passport, etc., and the current status in terms of the Immigration Act of a child that's in South Africa, technically speaking, illegal foreigner, but there are certain issues you follow. There are a lot of problems in that regard, but I can hand over to Tsitsi if you would.
Thank you.
Thank you. The issue about traveling for those people who do not have proper documentation to be in the country, I think it will be difficult. I do not foresee a situation where if they don't come forward and indicate what is it their lawful stay that they have in the country says, will be able to issue them with passport. We first need to properly document them in terms of the Immigration Act. But with regard to refugees, I know they are issued with travel documents to enable them to travel, but not necessarily to the country of origin. So I think I would leave it there because I do not have much facts on that. But we've noted the issue about objective conditions, why did we draft, that will go back and engage the branch and ensure that whatever we, when we refine the bill, based on this, the discussions or deliberations that members would have, we take that into account. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Edward. I'm resisting the temptation to speak on the matter that was raised by Advocate Erasmus about certain issues of corruption in the Eastern Cape. I'll leave it for some other day. I'll tell you some story there. I'm doing my best to resist the temptation, but let's leave it for another day. You may continue, sir.
Thank you, Chairman. If I continue to the last page, which is page 4 of the submission by PASOP, it deals with citizenship through marriage. I think the issues raised here are exactly as they were raised by the Law Society of South Africa, as Advocate Erasmus dealt with them, regarding the prescribed period. To say, currently the Act talks to the period of 2 years, but however, in the bill we are saying we are going to prescribe the period, and the question then says, what then will be that period? And I think, as we indicated, we deliberate, and there were comments on that to say, whenever we're going to draft the regulations and dealing with these particular issues, the portfolio committee would want to engage on whatever would have had in the, would we have prescribed in the regulations. So I think, in line with those earlier comments, I would leave it at that. Then the next issue deals with also that was dealt with regarding that citizenship should be granted to spouse of a South African citizen if the applicant is either a permanent or refugee. Then further goes to say, B, has been married for at least 1 year prior to applying, and if he or she has lived in the RSA continuously for at least 1 year, it still talks to the 2 year period. Then going further, it says citizenship should be retained even if the marriage is dissolved by choice after 2 years, if the applicant submits an application to be naturalized prior to ending the marriage. And I think the only situations or circumstances we are creating for is where there is marriage and where there is dissolution of marriage by death. So one will be the surviving spouse. But what is being suggested here is that if people tend to divorce prior to the 2 year period, we should also consider them. But the difficulty that we would have, and as we currently experience in certain immigration areas, is that people will then enter into a marriage, but while they realize that that will enable them to get citizenship, then they'll still go on and divorce. And we're not necessarily saying people would not divorce, but we are afraid of those kind of situations where we would not have a guarantee that the marriage was never what members indicated or raised as bogus marriages. So we would not want to treat into that area. Therefore, we would maintain only the circumstances where a person is married, with the prescribed period being 2 years currently, and only those cases where a person is a surviving spouse, that happens to have had death that separated the couple. And that would, there is a last paragraph that I will read, which deals with refugees should be included in the same category as permanent residents. Therefore, a refugee who marries a South African citizen should be eligible to apply for citizenship after at least 1 year of entering into the aforementioned marriage and living in the RSA for at least one continuous year. And I think we come into this issue, we had not properly thought of these or dealt with this, in that it creates a bit of a situation where a refugee marries a South African. And the question then becomes, is this refugee going to move over to a permit under the Immigration Act? And, you know, I think that I should say we have not addressed, but as we make responses in writing, we'll adequately address it in terms of what should be the situation that we are proposing, whether we take the suggested proposal or otherwise. I think that will be the end of the submission by PASOP, and the submissions that we have had, I think, will only be these four. Thank you. I don't know if Advocate Erasmus might have other issues on the bill that we have picked up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Advocate Erasmus.
Gina, thank you very much. There are no other issues that we're going to raise on the specific bill. Just to on this bill, just to indicate that what Edward Smilamech has just indicated on whether you move over if you're a refugee, are you going to, and you're married to a South African citizen, are you moving over to the SA Citizenship Act, is it Refugees Act? I think that should also be a voluntary act, if I can use those words, by the individual themselves. Where do I want to find myself at the end of the day? And that's something that we'll look into as well when we go back. I don't think it should be forced on an individual to say they might want to stay a refugee for that matter, although married to a South African, and they must really look at the best way that was, or the best avenue that would suit them in exercising that discretion. Thanks, Chief.
I can only hazard a guess that the individual concerned would obviously look at the best dispensation possible. Members, any comment, question, remark? The Yerel Akbar Masizoli.
Thank you, Chairperson. The the challenge with the proposed amendment is Section 5B on the amendment bill. If you look at that, then obviously the submission that is made here on by PASOF. Yeah, but the issue of the number of years is that you'll find a situation where many people are going to go the route of marriages because it's longer. It's quite short, and no one can say, no, it's not true of a marriage. Now, it makes it very difficult. I can imagine how one would make sure that there is the statutes as they stand are made to be very more cumbersome and rigid for those who are coming with wrong intents, especially when they want to enter into marriages of convenience, or whatever, as we call them, bogus marriages. I was confronted by a woman who said to me, an old lady, saying, "Ish, member, Mr. Mnasela, will you please advise me? My daughter in the church met a man who we know works in the garden of the church. He's a very kind and humble man, but he can't find citizenship. He's a man that is holding a section, he's holding a temporary residence permit, which is, he's recognized. Now, they are saying this man is, he wants to get married to this woman, to the young lady. Now, the old lady comes to me and says, should she go on, or must she refuse? I said to her, you are a criminal, as you are saying it, if you allow her to do so. Now, she looked at me and said, am I a criminal? I said, yes, I need to tell her to back off. So the issue is, if they do not have a relationship, and this man is coming to say, I want to live in this country, I love this country, can I get married to your daughter? Remember, there are trade-offs here. There's money involved, there's benefits in this process. It's a multi-million dollar scheme. It's a market on its own. So it's important that whilst observing the good intentions of the number of years, Chair, but we take into account what are the other avenues that people may take so that they can try and avert, you know, this kind of very thorough, stringent and time-consuming factor. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honourable Member, I thank you. I'm just shocked by your example that this type of horse trading can happen in the house of the Lord or at the place of the house of the Lord. But that's another matter for Sunday prayer. Good folks, any other further comment? Memawin, I thought this portfolio committee had been able to get another member, but I don't see that member. Perhaps you can tell me outside this meeting what happened to the member. Masizola, I might just say that those who allocate members wanted to ensure that you are not the only man. They provided another man, so that there's more gender. It can be balanced, but a little bit of gender equity. So I can't see this man. He has disappeared. I must say, I saw him in the morning when I came into Parliament. He was very vocal somewhere. So passages of Parliament might have swallowed him. But that's another matter, good folks. Good folks, we have traversed down this road. I think for the day we have tried to say what we needed to say to seek to carry out our mandate of seeking to formulate the best possible legislation that we can under the current circumstances. We can only do our best. So we will continue with this process. Perhaps the next time we meet, we'll follow the other format which will expedite our work in giving us something with regard to the work that we have achieved up to now, and then perhaps also start working on the next bill. I was told that there's a bit of concern that what we are busy with should also get to the National Council of Provinces timelessly. But I was saying that we need to do what we need to do in this house properly. Otherwise, when it gets there, they'll wipe the floor with us and say, were these people conscientious about what they were doing? Do they take their work serious? So, whilst I'm mindful of the cycles of Parliament, I would not want us to be accused of some shoddy workmanship. We'd rather do it properly. And then when we hand over to the next house, it's the best that we could have done. So, Eddie, that's how it's going to be. We are going to try our best, you see. But we are not going to create miracles. Unfortunately, that gentleman was able to create wine out of water and provide lots of fish out of one fish and loaves of bread. We have not seen him recently. So we'll try our best here. Good folks, thank you very much. No one has lost their false teeth, so we are doing well. Members, stakeholders, legal advisors, law students, thanks. Meeting is adjourned.